When I talk to property investors, they often tell me using debt is a key advantage over other asset classes. In the stock market, using debt is often called gearing. The new BetaShares Wealth Builder Funds, ASX ticker symbols G200 and GHHF, offer moderate gearing across Australian and global shares for investors who are comfortable with the higher risks associated with gearing their investments. You can discover how they work by visiting betashares.com.au. Please don't forget that gearing magnifies gains and losses, so read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
Is there a Spotify Wrapped for investing? If you want to invest in shares or ETFs, our friends at Perla are more than one step ahead of the curve. On average, people who use Perla invest $1,750 every month. That's what we want to see, proper dollar cost averaging. With automated investing tools making your life simple, Perla investors have well and truly mastered the art of investing small bits lots of times. So, if you're ready to start growing your net worth in 2024, follow the link in your Spotify or Apple podcast player right now to discover how you can get started today.
Welcome to the Australian Finance Podcast.
I'm Kate Campbell.
And I'm Owen Rask.
And we're here to give you the tools and knowledge to invest both your time and money better.
If you're new, feel free to jump in with our Starter Pack series that aired in early 2022, or our Shares or ETF mini series.
We've got plenty to share with you in today's episode, but if you want to catch us on socials,
head to Rask Australia on Insta and Twitter.
I'm also found at Kate Campbell AUS on Insta.
And I'm Owen Rask AU on Insta.
Just beware of the fake accounts. We'll never DM you about trading strategies or crypto. And if it sounds a bit weird, it's probably not us.
And just one final heads up before we get into the show. This podcast contains general financial information only. Kate Campbell, welcome to this episode of the Australian Fine Arts Podcast. How are you?
I am doing very well this wonderful day, Owen.
Yes, it is a wonderful day. It's a semi-sun-shining day in Melbourne, and we're here in the studio, which is always lovely, and we're joined by Monique, who's behind, off-shot, out of the camera. But if you are watching on YouTube, trust us, she's here.
She loves listening to investing Q&As.
Off, out of sight, just making sure we're all accountable.
Best part of her day.
Yes, it is. And today we're talking about investing, and we're doing some Q&A. And with that comes an extra disclaimer, which everyone loves. Anything that we do mention on today's podcast is general in nature because we don't know people's circumstances. Even if you send us a question, which you can do via YouTube, if you're watching below the video in the description, there's a link there. Or if you're listening, wherever you're listening, if you're in your car and you're listening on Spotify, or maybe you're in the gym listening on Apple, for example, you can click the link that says ask a question, select the Australian Finance Podcast. And we don't know your personal circumstances. So what we'd like you to do is just to keep a fun name in the title where it asks you, and also don't give us heaps of information because we can't digest all of that and keep it general. So we will generalize every question that gets brought in, but just be sure to refer to the PDS if we mention an investment, or if you are still confused, seek the advice of a licensed and trusted professional. We do have a way to connect with the financial advisor via the link in the show notes. It says financial planning. There's also one for mortgage broking. Maybe in the future there'll be one for accounting. If you are an accountant, let us know. That's all there. Otherwise, head to moneysmart.gov.au. That's it, Kate. Let's get into some questions, shall we?
Well, I had one for you to start with, Owen.
Sure.
What was the investment that taught you the most?
So I was trying to think about this. Don't know exactly, but I can share one with you, which made me quite a bit of money at the same time as teaching me something, which was I bought Apple shares quite a while ago. I don't own them anymore directly. I have them, sure, through an ETF somewhere, maybe through IVV.
I mean, most of us would have them through an ETF and for our super fund.
Yeah, one of the biggest companies in the world. You'd expect that you have it somewhere. And so I invested in Apple shares directly through my brokerage account in the US. And at the time, Apple was not $100 a share. You can go back and look at the share price chart, and it was a long way from where it is today, and I did quite well out of it. And Apple was still a really good business, and the iPhones were selling like hotcakes, and they still are now, but they don't report the exact number of units anymore. So there was this period where Apple went through this kind of uncertainty, where analysts were a bit spooked. They were thinking, well, how much will people pay for iPhones and these types of things? And I remember looking around at all the news headlines at the time, and they were all very negative. They were like, Apple can't make the transition to their subscriptions. Fast forward a few years, everyone's paying for, you know, the iCloud and all this sort of stuff. Apple TV, you know, this, the list goes on and on. And anyway, before all that, I was looking around and I noticed that Apple had been around for a long time. So what I did is I got kind of like the biggest news headlines every year that were negative against Apple and just summarized them all. And basically, the only common theme amongst every year's negativity was it's overvalued. Everyone said it was overvalued every single year. And I ended up writing an article on this years ago about this idea that markets climb a wall of worry. So this is a saying that's pretty well trod. And what it means is that there's always something to be negative about, but the stock market still seems to keep going up. Not every year, but often. And if you just look back in time at one of your investments and you just search for headlines, you will see some negativity. And that at the time is pretty scary. But a lot of the good companies just keep climbing. A lot of the good ETFs just keep climbing. So that would be my lesson. And that's what taught me probably the most about individual stock picking is Apple. The biggest boring company in the world. And I thought its ecosystem was amazing, but everyone seemed to be negative. So that's that one. What about you?
My investment would have to be one of the very first longer-term investments I made. I've spoken on the podcast about doing some silly stuff with my brokerage account at the beginning, which taught me a lot because I was only playing with a few hundred dollars. I didn't have too much to lose. But what taught me the most is when I invested in an international managed fund. And this is before I really understood what an ETF was. So this seemed like a good option at the time. And I remember at the start, I could invest $1,000 and set up a $200 a month regular contribution plan. So I did that. And it's been going. I paused slightly during COVID when I planned to go overseas and do the travel thing that didn't happen at the time. But it has been running every month for years and years and years now. And now it's quite substantial, and it's something that I could do something with one day if I wanted to. And so that's taught me the power of automated investing, because I've seen how that little amount every month just taken from my savings account, I haven't had to think about it, I haven't had to make a decision for years. It's just happened in the background, and it's slowly dollar cost averaged over time, and I've slowly built a little nest egg in this international managed fund. And I plan on continuing that for a while longer. I'm still happy with that investment. It's been growing nicely, and it's taught me the importance of automating your finances and not having to make all these decisions.
Before automated investing was cool, Kate, you were doing it.
Old school.
Old school. Just people probably don't know this, but dollar cost averaging has been around for many decades, particularly with managed funds, as you say, where you go to the website, you set up a regular BPAY, which is what investors can do with us, by the way, or you have a direct deposit facility set up. These things have been going for a long time, and it's good to see you were doing that. You're a pioneer in the community, Kate. So
Before I really knew what I was doing, but it was a small enough amount that you didn't really notice it each month.
That's great. It's wonderful. Good stuff.
All right. The first question we've got today is about car loans from Pinky with No Brain. And I'm assuming that's a play on a TV show.
Yes, it is, Kate. Probably a little bit before your time, but it is definitely in my era, Pinky and the Brain. For those of you that are familiar, what a time that was to be alive.
All right. The question says, the day I turned 18, I applied for a $15,000 car loan over 7 years at 11% interest. I was earning barely $400 per week. And after 3 years, I sold it for exactly half of what I paid. So what's that?
$7,500,
which didn't even cover the outstanding loan balance. I still consider it to be the worst decision I ever made. What would you say to someone who is thinking of doing something similar today?
Don't do it would probably be the first thing. It's like when you ask people if they could go back in time, what's one thing they would do with their money? And everyone says buy Bitcoin or invest in Amazon or something like that. Like hindsight is a wonderful thing. But the reality is, you know, a lot of people who spend their time thinking about investing could do much more with their money if they focus on the other side of their balance sheet, which is focus on the savings side. I can empathize with this person because I did exactly the same thing. I don't think it was on the day I turned 18, but it was around that time. I didn't have the luxury of having a lot of money saved up. You know, I had to spend a lot of money on just living at the time. So saving up to buy a car probably wasn't something that I was able to do. At least not a car that was like pretty reliable and all that sort of stuff. So I ended up getting a car loan for a ute of all things, which I probably didn't need. And it did depreciate pretty quickly as per this person's comment. Like, they would think in this instance, if you just heard this paragraph, you would think that $15,000 minus $7,500, that's the loss. When I did this calculation, because when I started learning more about finance, I did it for myself, and I realized that had I kept my car, which at the time was around about, I think I paid over $15,000, it might have been like $18,000 at the time. Had I kept my car over the 7 years of that loan, it would have cost me $75,000. So you think about that for a second. Three or four times the amount of the actual car's cost is what it would cost you. And the reason is the interest is extreme. In this case, it's 11%, which is actually not that bad. Some people get sucked into thinking that those 1% interest things are actually real when there's so many other things behind the scenes that get people. The other thing is like servicing. The other thing is registration. Insurance for a young person. I'm going to guess in this person's instance, $15,000 car. If you get the loan, the bank will force you to have fully comp insurance.
Mm. Especially when you're on your P plates too.
Yeah. It could be $3,000. Could be more for this type of insurance. So you've got that over 7 years. That's more than the cost of the car. You've got petrol nowadays. You've got tolls. The list goes on and on and on and on. And so in my opinion, this is a massive – there's three things you need to get right in life. There's your educational costs. There's your housing costs, whether it's rent or buy. And then there's your transport costs. So in this instance, maybe there was no option for this person.
Like a lot of people would need a car at 18 for their job or to go to uni, especially if they're not living near public transport, which Absolutely. We're so used to in the city, but regional students don't have access to the same level of public transport.
Well, in my instance, the bus only came about once every hour, and then I'd get to the station and the train would only come, unless it was peak times in the morning, once every 45 minutes. In a car, the equivalent drive would be 20 minutes. It could take me 2 hours just to get to where I needed to go, and that's if it ran on time. So, the reality is a lot of people need a car, particularly at this age if you've got a job or something like that. But I would just go for the absolute minimum viable vehicle that gets you from A to B, particularly when you're young and you're still at uni. We all see everyone else get cars, maybe they get helped by their parents, or maybe they are a tradie and they can get some off on tax, or maybe they've already got a solid income. But this is one of those things where this is – two steps, three steps back to go forward one in very early days. And the only thing worse than a personal loan like this, realistically for the most people, is a credit card when you turn 18. They're absolutely horrible things. They say, go and take it, go traveling. Like you could take this exact example, apply a credit card for an overseas Kentucky holiday. That in my belief, that's a very bad debt. Even though you get an experience, you're paying for something that kind of vanishes pretty quick. At least with the car, there's a tangible asset that you can sell. Your downside is kind of minimized.
Can you get secondhand cars for much less than $15,000? I'm not a car owner, so I have no context.
Yeah, it's getting hard. I was thinking about this on the way in today. It's getting harder to buy a good secondhand car because the secondhand car market in Australia is pretty shallow. There's not many options for people. So after I sold my car, I went and got, so I had this like really nice ute that I fixed up and I used to go, you know, camping and stuff with it. But it was just so stressful for me going through uni. So, so stressful. I couldn't go out with friends because I'd be paying his car loan back and whatever. But after that, I ended up getting rid of it and I ended up getting a Holden Barina, which is like one of those tiny little beep, beep cars that you're going to see everywhere. And yeah, it wasn't something that I was necessarily proud of, but it saved me so much money and it was just liberating. So I would say get the minimum viable product, something that if it is reliable, do that. People in inner city probably don't have as big of a worry now because of things like Uber, you know, those types of things. They do add up. But massive cost for young people, It's an opportunity to go backwards very quickly if you're not careful. Minimum viable product is what we say in building a business. Minimum viable product for transport here as well. Yeah. One day you'll get a car, Kate, and maybe by the time you get it, it'll be autonomous or...
Well, that's what I'm waiting. I'm waiting for fully legal self-driving cars that... Yeah. Oh, the ethical dilemmas, though, with self-driving cars.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Oh, mm-hmm.
Whole nother podcast. But anyway, our next question's from Investment Noob. New to the pod, recently more or less having to start again with finances. I want to build up an emergency fund, normal savings, and invest in some ETFs.
Yep.
What would be the best way to split up my extra income between those three buckets? So starting from scratch, no emergency fund, no savings, no investments. How would you go about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I might actually just revert really quickly to the first one. If you're a parent in that situation or a grandparent, The tried and tested method for helping a child get a car is to do a matching system where, you know, matching savings. So if they save $500, you save $500 or you tip in. It just gives them a bit of savings habit before they turn 18 and they have to go down the car loan route. So if you do have that ability, good on you, and try to figure out something like that. Now, for this one with the investment noob asking whether to do emergency fund, normal savings, or in some ETFs, I think the usual rules apply here that it's the emergency fund is the most important. An emergency fund does double as a savings element. So they're probably suggesting that they need the emergency fund and then what to do with the extra cash. Emergency fund is the only thing that matters in the early days because effectively to get an emergency fund, you have to have paid off your debt. So what you would do is you would look at, if you do have debt, you would look at consolidating some of those debts. So that might mean you add them together, you kind of refinance them, or you could use an avalanche strategy or a domino strategy. There's so many different strategies that come out. Barefoot wrote about a few of these in his book. And, you know, some of those might be pay off the smallest, highest fee one first or pay off the highest fee one that has the big balance first. It doesn't really matter as long as you're on that kind of, you're in motion. So emergency fund first. Then once you get to break even and you've got a little balance in there that you're comfortable with, then you cut up the credit cards, then you get rid of the personal loans and all that type of thing, which is a whole thing in itself. And then you look at, okay, now I've got my emergency fund. Let's get it to 3 or 6 months of cash flow, of living expenses, sorry. Preferably 6 months. That would probably be the one. And then you look at investing. And the reason is that if you look at investing first, one, the return of a good ETF is not the same. It's not as high as the return that you get from saving on paying off a credit card first. So a credit card might charge you 20%, but realistically, the Australian share market returns at best 10%, say, on average. So you're already going backwards, even if you are invested. The second thing around this is that if you own an investment, one in every 4 or 5 years, there's a question on this soon, but one in every 4 or 5 years, the stock market falls. And falls hard, like 20% or more. That's on average. So if you are in the unlucky situation where you think, oh, all of my investments have fallen at exactly the same time as your personal finance hygiene is out of whack and you need to pay a credit card bill, you're selling your ETFs at a discount at the wrong time, right before they could bounce straight back up, to pay off a credit card, which is charging you more. So it's a real probably double or triple whammy. So you're better off having the savings habit and the emergency fund first, paying you interest, by the way, and then investing your extra income from there. That's how I think about it, okay? How do you think about it?
Yeah, it could take quite some time to build up an emergency fund, especially if you're starting over. It might take you a year to get to level of cash that you're comfortable with. I think that is a perfect time. You're building those skills. You're learning how to put money aside every month. You're learning how to budget and save. It's a great time to learn about investing and do all these good things, listen to the podcast, read some books, learn as much as you can so that when you do have that emergency fund, you've got your short-term savings goals sorted out, you can just jump into investing and you've got that knowledge. And we've talked about this in the past, but it's okay to dabble maybe with $5 a month in a micro investing app while you're focusing on paying off debt and building your emergency fund, because this gives you an ability to learn and to explore and to start to understand ETFs, because it's very different learning about it with some money in the game, even if it's only $5. It's a whole different experience to just learning about investing theoretically for 1, 2, 3 years.
Yeah, just like driving in the parking lot. You don't just go straight onto the freeway and see how you go. You just take little steps at a time. And I think you're so right there that a lot of people do want to jump straight to investing, even though they've got the credit card bills or the personal loans in the first question. And why not do both? You can. But if you have your goals set up, you might have like a goal for the next year. I had a friend, for example, who paid off a $19,000 CBA loan that he had, just a personal loan for traveling. And he hated it. It hung over his head for years. And we sat down and he wanted to start investing. I said to him, mate, well, probably the first thing you could look at is paying off that loan. Imagine how you'd feel when you get to the end of that. That'd be much better than the feeling of making 2% on an ETF or something like that. And he did that. It took him about 11 months, but he really saved hard. He didn't go out. He really knuckled down, didn't buy those extra things, you know, and he got there and he messaged me. And he was so excited. He just wanted to tell someone. He told me and I was like, oh, that's great. And he's since gone on and he's traveled in overseas. He's lived overseas. He's done all these types of things. And so, yeah, that's what he wanted to do. And I think if you just imagine that future state, what will make you feel better? Probably paying off that account. But in the meantime, like you said, a very low-cost education is just investing 10 or 20 bucks a week. I think that might even be a question that we have in a minute. That's a really easy way to learn about investing. And I don't think there's anything quite like it, if you ask me. Putting that extra 50 bucks or 100 bucks in is real money. And it's great. So I think that's actually the next question, Kate.
Yes. The next question is from The Hoppo 8?
Yeah, I think it's like the Hoppo 8. I think it's because the question is about compounding with beer.
Yes.
Yes.
That's an interesting one. So I started recycling my beer stubbies, 10 cents each. So I'm not sure what state that is.
It could be Vic. I think that might be Victoria has just introduced it now. Adelaide and places like this have always had it.
Yeah, I still haven't made use of the scheme in Victoria.
Yeah, there's those machines. You just go up and you put your stuff in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And want to be able to add that money straight to my shares account. The Vanguard app doesn't allow transfers under $200. Is there a similar ETF you could recommend that will allow transfers of $2 to $5?
Yeah, so we don't recommend a lot of products on the show, but just full disclosure, we're going to mention Perla simply because it's able to do this, but it is a long-term sponsor. We do not get paid for suggesting this. There are other platforms available, which we'll mention as well, which are not sponsors. All the same, go and explore these. But we don't necessarily, quote unquote, recommend anything. It's important to understand that's what a financial planner is for. So Vanguard's personal investor services does have an auto-invest feature, which this person may be referring to as well, and that is $200.
Yeah. I think you're allowed to transfer money
in
with no minimum into the Vanguard cash account.
Yes, that's my understanding.
I've just had a look at their FAQ.
But it won't purchase. It won't do auto invest or anything like that.
It will just slowly build up that cash balance.
Yeah. So there's often no minimums of transferring money in and just leaving it in there. It's when the actual investing takes place. Now, so that's different to, say, CommSec Pocket, which is $50 minimum to start. Perla is, I don't think there's much of a minimum. Sharesies, which is a Kiwi-based investing platform, I think the minimum on that is like 1 cent, which is tiny. So that's all about kind of like opening up investors that haven't previously had the ability to invest. So all of those platforms do it. Raise does it as well. In this question, I noticed that there was a little bit of a Confucius in here. They said the Vanguard app doesn't allow transfers and then go on to say, is there a similar ETF? So the Vanguard app is not an ETF. It's an investment platform. What you buy inside the platform is the ETF or the managed fund in case of Vanguard. So for example, Perla is not an ETF. It is a platform for buying ETFs and shares. So that's an important distinction. But realistically, if your platform offers something called HIN, H-I-N, this is like an additional layer of security that we have in Australia. Typically, you need to meet a minimum of $500. And the reason that you have to do that is because the ASX, which is the stock exchange, basically sets that. And you need to have a full parcel to get your HIN. So that's why you often see the minimums of $500. But there's no minimum in terms of transferring money in. So even if you go with a HIN-based platform, there's no minimum on transferring money in. It's just they won't invest for you until you get to that.
And many people listening would do something similar. So every fortnight or every month, $200 gets transferred into their cash investment account. And then once it hits a certain level, maybe for them it's $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, they then go and invest that money. So they just let the cash build up a little bit.
Yeah, and that's perfectly reasonable. I can give you an example from from our own experience with building Rask Invest, which is our investment portfolios. People can pay money in, but it won't trade until it gets to a certain size. And the reason is, behind the scenes of these investment platforms, ours included, is that there needs to be a minimum amount of money to make a full purchase. Some people may remember a few years ago that the IVV ETF, which I mentioned earlier from iShares, had, I think it was about a $600 share price. And so if you're only putting in 10 bucks, you're not going to be able to cover the full price of the investment. So you can't make the investment. So they have to protect themselves so that they don't take your money and try to invest it. And then you might get fees or dishonor charges or whatever. So there's none of that going on. And that's why you often have the minimums. But with the platforms that we mentioned before, Sharesies, Perla Micro, Raise, these are custodial models. They bundle your money together and they allow you to, as a community, effectively invest in smaller parcels. You know, it's probably neither here nor there for some investors. For me, I prefer the HIN-based model now that my portfolio is over $500.
But you can understand someone, the motivation of going, oh, I've got $2 from here. I just want to invest it.
Yeah. And I still use the Raise platform. You know, I still use the Raise platform for that. And you know, we've talked about it at length on the show before, how you can use those platforms and not even know that you're investing, like if you have the roundup features and those types of things. So it's a great way to keep maintaining the habit, investing small amounts lots of times.
Yeah, I know a few people who they do online surveys or maybe they do focus groups or they get some extra money from selling things on Gumtree and they always designate that specific money to an app like Raise or Sharesies and they just invest it. So it's just a little bit on the side and they get to designate it to a specific place.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, I invest in ETFs and individual shares to still have Raise, right? That's still going. My sister uses Perla. My young sister, I've set it up in my name though, because she's under the age of 18. And so, you know, all of these things, you would make the tools work for you. Pick the one that does the job correctly. You don't have to have one. I think that's what we're trying to get at here is you don't have to have one. But that's a good question because a lot of people do dollar cost average and they don't have $500 or $1,000 in one go.
It might take you a long time to get to that minimum market size. We were talking about the $500. So this option might be better for you starting out.
Yeah, absolutely. The next question, Kate, is we need like a dark cloud noise coming overhead to say something really bad is coming.
Yes. The next question is from Chicken Little. And I added, is the sky falling? Because if you've seen this animated movie, that's what happens.
Okay.
I think it's because it's aliens. It was a long time since I watched it, but I appreciated the effort with the name there.
Okay.
The person asks, if I believe there'll be a recession in the next 3 to 6 months, but have a large sum to invest, now we get this one a lot, is it better to invest now, time the market, or dollar cost average over 12 months?
Yeah. So let's think about this, a recession. So a recession is, in academic circles, it would be when the economy, so the things that we're producing every day, the coffees that are sold, the tradies that are installing a new fridge, all of those things, when that goes backwards for 2 quarters or half a year. So you get an economic reading called GDP, gross domestic product. When that goes backwards twice in a row, so 2 quarters, that's technically a recession. We had one of those during COVID, but many people remember that the stock market went up a lot. I don't know the exact figure, but it went up a long way during COVID. And this is the perfect example of where someone is maybe thinking about the economy going bad, but the stock market doing the opposite. How does that happen? Well, there are a few reasons that it would happen. But in the case of COVID, what happened is there was a, like, snap your fingers, there was a shock to the system. Everyone was like, I don't know how bad this COVID thing's going to be. Sounds like, based on everything that we're hearing from Italy and China, 10% of the population could die. Right? That was what we were hearing in the news. So naturally, you as an investor, you're freaking out thinking everything's going to be shut down. I might not even be here tomorrow. I might as well sell, right? So it would be natural that everyone sold. But then once we got to the bottom of that crash, some people might remember, we started to hear of things called like RATs or rapid tests. We started to hear and get more data on people surviving. And we started to see kind of the more actual empirical information coming through and experts saying what we know so far. And what happened in the almost the blink of an eye during COVID?
It was in a month period, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was so quick in March 2020.
Yeah, 2020. What happened in that split second is then people were like, oh, we're all not going to die. And then all of a sudden the thing shot up the other side. And the reason that that happens is the returns that you get from the stock market from one day or one week or one month to the next is not based on what's actually happening in the economy. It's based on what people think could happen in the economy. And if you're anything like me, you can wake up tomorrow on the wrong side of the bed and think some pretty negative stuff versus what you're feeling today or the next day and so on. And so the market is just like that. The stock market and financial markets are just like that. It's just like our emotions waking up every day. Warren Buffett and his mentor, Ben Graham, called it Mr. Market. Mr. Market's this kind of lunatic that comes up to you and is like, hey, will you buy this today for 5% less? Hey, can I buy that from you for 5% more? And there's always this thing that's happening every day. And it's like this crazy person's rocking up at your door and saying, buy or sell. And really, you don't need to do either of those things. And so I just wanted to call that out, is like the stock market is not the economy because of many different reasons. That's just one of them. The second thing is that if you are a long-term investor, you can expect the stock market to crash one in every 5 years. And there's a fun little quip that's, we're getting closer to the next market crash than the last one, which is a bit of a play on words, getting closer to the next one than the last one. And over decades, if not centuries, the stock market has crashed multiple times and still gone up. And there's so many ways you can slice and dice the data, but basically it would seem that it's almost impossible to avoid the worst days in investing, because what happens is when you look at those charts and data and all that stuff that they throw at you, what you find is that people will say things like, if you just avoided the five worst days, your returns would be blah. Or if you just invested on the best days, your returns would be blah. But what they don't tell you is the worst days are often next door to the best days. So it's almost impossible to be in the market, then out the market, then in the market, then out the market. Like, it's almost impossible. And I would say it is impossible.
Yeah. And in trying to avoid the worst days, you end up avoiding the best days as well. And that severely impacts your returns long term. Not to mention it makes your investing complicated. You're going to have a tax headache.
Yep.
Either way, even if you make a loss, there's things you're going to have to do at tax time. You're going to be paying brokerage and you're probably going to be stressing a lot about it. Investing's not going to feel simple to you. You're going to be worrying about it every single day, looking at newspapers, trying to figure out, is today the day I get back in? Is today the day I sell? What do I do?
Yeah, you'd much rather do other things, surely, with your time than worry about that sort of stuff. So there was a bit of data that I saw from the website called Market Index, a wonderful Australian website, if you're familiar with it, /statistics on their website. And there's some data in there that shows, based on some historical data, that since about I think it was 123 years ago, the stock market has returned on average, this is the Australian stock market, about 13%. Now, that's not, don't take that as like, that's going to always return 13%. I doubt it will. And it's definitely not suggesting every year is like that. But if you just think about that, 13.2%, at the same time, we had two world wars, we had a depression, we had many different prime ministers, many different US presidents, Cold War, Vietnam, dot-com crisis, 87 Asian financial crisis, the GFC, COVID. Like, you can just keep going on and on and on and on. Maths, like, there's been some really strange things that have happened over the last 123 years. And yet the stock market's still gone up. And I think if you just remind yourself of that, even in the really scary times, like, things can be pretty bad, but they can get a lot better from that point on. And I think ultimately what you'll conclude, if you're anything like me, is you'll conclude that the stock market is the place where innovation happens. So if you're a long-term investor, you're basically suggesting that innovation will never happen. I can't remember his name, but I think it was the US Patents Office, the commissioner, I think he said in the year 1900, all that has been, all that can be invented has been invented, which is bizarre now that you look back on it. But since then, there's been a lot of innovation and the world's greatest companies have emerged since then. So now let's answer the actual question. If you've got a large sum to invest, how do you invest and what do you do? I think there's a few assumptions here. Number one is that it's a diversified portfolio. You don't just go all in on one stock or all in on one market. For example, even just going all in on one property is a very big risk. It's just happened to work for so many people over the last two decades. But there are instances here and around the world where that's a very, very, very bad decision. So number one is you've got a diversified portfolio. Make it mostly out of ETFs because they're low cost and they're diversified by their nature. Number two is that you don't invest money that you need, which is obvious for a lot of people for the reasons that we just laid out. Number three is know yourself. Some people would be okay putting money straight to work. I probably wouldn't, to be honest. As much as I like to be a long-term investor and I'm a financial professional, I do like to break things up. So I would break it up.
Especially if you're newer to investing. It can feel very scary to invest a significant sum of money at once. Like a lot of people give you the advice, if you get an inheritance, that you should just wait a little bit and talk to people and not make a decision rashly with a large sum of money, especially if you're dealing with a lot of emotions and you're new to investing.
Yeah, and get advice in that situation. If you've never done it before, don't just take control of it thinking that I've got to do it now and it's me or no one. Like, get advice, get help, get two sets of advice if it's a substantial amount of money. And because I'll take into account things like your goals. But the other thing is, if you are a new investor, and let's say you inherited $300,000, and this is the first real big amount of money that you've ever got, I wouldn't even limit myself to 12 months. I'd probably go, I'm going to invest, if I've got 300 grand, I'm going to invest 100 grand broken up evenly every month for the next year. So I would start with just round figures, let's say 9 grand this month, 9 grand next month, 9 grand the month after. And the reason I'd do that, and it's probably not what people suspect, is you would have the rest of it sitting in a savings account earning 5% returns, which is pretty darn good. So there's no rush. Like, you don't have to rush right now. 3 or 4 years ago, you probably felt like you had to rush because you were getting 1% interest or nothing, depending on where you put your money. Now, you're getting a really good interest. Like, if you think about that, you're 300 grand, you're getting 15 grand a year. Yeah, sure, you pay tax, but it keeps you company while you're learning about the stock market. So, sky's falling, chicken little. Oh, could be, who knows? Really, who knows? But over the long term, investing in the stock market is investing in businesses, and businesses solve the most problems for society. So that's why people do it. And it comes down to your behavioral aspects, in my opinion. Dave Gow from Strong Money Australia, in his book, he did a lot of work onto this. Property, shares, dollar cost averaging, buy now, buy in a year, whatever. And I'll take Dave's words out of his mouth, but basically the conclusion is just do something. So just do something.
And there's a lot less urgency than you believe there is.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You can just listen to this podcast for the next 12 months and just keep it in a savings account. And the beauty of that is you're probably going to get around 5% interest, which is pretty good.
And
we did our free courses.
Episode a few months back with your market update, Owen, on your timeless investing lessons. So that would be a good resource for people to listen to as well.
Yeah, we'll pop that in the show notes. That's a good one. Yeah. And this is a question we get a lot, and particularly with the recent launch of our Rask Invest service, a lot of people wanted to invest a lot up front, and that's fine. People can do that because the portfolio is diversified, but realistically, most people will just put a little bit in and a little bit more as they get comfortable and a little bit more as they get more comfortable, and I think that's the way investing should be done. You know, instead of trying to buy low, sell high or something like that, just buy and then buy again. I like that. All right. I like those questions, Kate.
Yeah. You think I chose okay from the list?
Yeah. I think they're unreal. I just love hearing from people. And I think that every time we get to hear some good questions, we can really test ourselves as well. And we can try and identify what are the core problems that people need help with. And we would encourage you to send in more questions because not just on the Australian Finance Podcast, but the Investors Podcast, the Business Podcast, the Property Podcast. We can also manage questions across all of those, and we do it with all different opinions and perspectives on different problems.
Yeah, so there's a link in the show notes of the podcast description that you can send your question in, especially if you want to give Owen a chance to bring out his inner philosopher.
Yes, yes. Just like we did today, I actually do love this because it is an opportunity for me to share more of my opinion. I do. I mean, everyone loves I don't love the sound of my own voice, but.
Are you sure?
But no, but what I've realized, and what I think what we realized as a team last year at our events is that I play host to some people, as you do, as Chris and Pete do, as Amy does, as everyone on the shows do, Drew does. And what people in the community seem to want to hear is from us a lot of the time. So if you do, like, we get a really good cross-sectional look at people. So what I mean by that is, like, I think there's something really special and really humbling about what we do, and that is that we get to speak to so many different people who are experts. And unless you listen to every single episode, you don't get, like, the summary version of that very easily. So hopefully you do like the Q&As. And if you do, let us know, write into us. We do love feedback. And yeah, sorry if you have to hear my voice for too much. So Kate, this is heaps of fun. Always love doing the Q&As with you. So thank you for thanks for putting this together, and thanks for joining me.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Australian Finance Podcast. We hope you learned something new and were able to take one thing away from this episode.
If you're keen to learn more, head on over to RASC Education and take one of our free money and investing courses. You could even become a RASC Core member for less than your Netflix subscription each month. And don't forget to subscribe for new episodes in your inbox every week.
Plus, if you enjoyed the show, we'd love you to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and send any questions our way via the link in the description. And before we go on, did this podcast contain personal financial advice just for me?
Absolutely not, Kate. Our podcast actually contains general financial information only. What that means is the information does not take into account your financial needs, goals, objectives, or even your situation. So because of that, it's important that you consider if the information is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on it.
If that all sounds a bit confusing or you're still working out what your needs are, it's a great idea to consult a licensed and trusted financial planner. And don't forget to do your own research.
Are you thinking about starting your wealth-creating journey, but not sure where to put your hard-earned dollars? InvestSmart can help. InvestSmart offers a free quiz that makes it easy to find the right InvestSmart ETF portfolio to help you reach your goals. Just visit investsmart.com.au and hit Get Started. Answer a few simple questions about your goals and how much you want to invest, and you'll get a tailored statement of advice with a portfolio recommendation. You can visit investsmart.com.au for a no-obligations free statement of advice. This ad is brought to you by InvestSmart Advice, AFSL 334107. For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.